Welcome to the Republican Professor. Welcome to 2025. It is the season for appointments to the executive branch, confirmed by the Senate, and appointments to the judicial branch, confirmed by the Senate. And I greet you. It's 2025 years after the Big Bang, right? No. After what? Well, I think you know the answer. Starts with the J. Good to see you again. One of the judicial appointments up is a vacancy on the Ninth Circuit and a vacancy on the DC Circuit, a vacancy. There's all sorts of vacancies. And we got a vacancy for the Department of Justice. Who's going to run the Department of Justice as Attorney General? And who's going to be head of the FBI? And we're back at the FBI. Violation of Fourth Amendment civil liberties in the Snitko case. We left at standard of review last time on page 1260, but as is my custom, I'm going to quote from the text of the Constitution. Gorsuch was famous for saying, let's start with the text of the Constitution. I don't know why he's famous for saying that. Should be just common knowledge. But let's go ahead and get the Fourth Amendment in front of us. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. And no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Going to read it again. The right of the people. What does that tell you? It's not the right of the government. It's the right of the people, which means sometimes it's called an individual right. Each person to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. Their persons means their body. What they have on them, what they have in their possession, against unreasonable searches and seizures. Now, the word unreasonable invites a searching inquiry into reasonability. It's circumstantial, but the standard is not circumstantial, it's fact specific. It invites an inquiry that's fact specific, but the standard doesn't change. Reasonability is the standard. That's the law. And I want you to see how this is phrased. The right of the people. They're talking about this as if this right is well known and it pre-exists this. It's not saying, hey, guess what? We're creating a new right. You've never heard of it before. And we'll call it this. That's not how it reads. It reads as if the right is already known. It's a pre-existing right. The right of the people. Well, which one? Yeah, the right, that one. You know, the right. It's already there. The right, which one? Okay, well, the right to be secure. It's the right of the people. To be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against what? Well, it doesn't say all searches and seizures. Well, who's the subject of the verb search and seize? It would be the government. That's the subject of the verb that's not mentioned. But it's against the government. And the government has a lawful obligation to be reasonable. Well, what does that mean? It doesn't say. All it says is it's got to be reasonable. You could drive a Mack truck through that, but you could also make a defense. In other words, it's giving the people something to stand on. Reasonability. The government does not have a right to be unreasonable in searches and seizures. That right shall not be violated. And no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause. What does that mean? Well, the word probable is there. What does that mean? Well, it means likely. That's what the word probable means. It means that there's a likely reason. Well, what's that mean? If there's a probability under 50%, I would say that's not probable. I don't think that's reasonable. Supported by oath or affirmation, well, it means somebody's got to swear their reputation depends on what their reputation is the hinge for this warrant. And particularly, that's an interesting adverb. Particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Keep that in mind as we continue on Snitko versus US. If you want me to do a summary here of what we've already covered, I'm going to send you back to the other one and I'm going to say to you, can I just say this to you? Okay. Can I just say this to you? All right. Pay attention now. Write this down. You are a lazy bastard if you don't go back and watch them before you get to this. I'm not going to summarize. You're a lazy bastard. It's never been easier to print this out. It's never been easier. It's right there. You don't have to go to the law library. You are a lazy bastard. You have no one to blame but yourself for your own ignorance if you persist and your stubbornness. You have free will. Go over there and print it out and catch up yourself. I'm not going to waste any more time with your laziness. The standard of review. We review an order denying a motion made pursuant to Rule 41G by parties against whom no criminal charges have been brought for an abuse of discretion. And by the way, guys, if you take yourself to have a right to vote and you're this lazy that you won't go review, you don't deserve the right to vote. And I know that I can't take it away from you, but you don't deserve it. You're a lazy bastard. Okay? And we're all screwed. The more people are like that. A district court abuses its discretion, or now remember, this is an appeals court. I said this last time that the appeals court is doing its job here. A district court, which is lower court, abuses its discretion when it makes an error of law or its decision results in an unreasonable, there's that constitutional word again, finding of material fact. We review pure questions of law de novo. analysis. The supplemental instructions to take this case out of the inventory search context. As discussed above, the district court reasoned that to determine whether the government search exceeded the bounds of the warrant must ascertain whether the government conducted a constitutionally proper inventory search. And to ascertain whether the government conducted a constitutionally proper inventory search, the district court applied our court's precedents governing the inventory search exception to the warrant requirement, which includes a test for assessing when an inventory is, quote, pretextual, unquote, and therefore invalid. Invalid just means unreasonable. Okay. As a threshold matter, however, plaintiffs argue that the district court should not have assumed that the inventory search doctrine extends to the context of this case. Specifically, they argue that the supplemental instructions, which were the operative instructions on the ground, were not the kind of standardized policy the inventory search doctrine contemplates. Now I'm on page 1261. Go to Google Scholar. Go to Case Law, Federal Courts, Snitko versus U.S., Ninth Circuit. Pull it up. Scroll down to 1261. Print it out. Follow along. The inventory search doctrine is an exception to the warrant requirement that allows authorities to search items within their lawful custody. Now, why would they want to do that? Why would there be an exception to the warrant requirement to give the government a power to search items within their lawful custody? I'm going to give you a second to think about that. Well, there's an intersectionality, as the kids are fond of saying now, of sources of law that come into play here. Because there may be a source of law that holds the government responsible financially for what they have custody of from an insurance perspective against thought. Theft and loss, damage, etc. And to protect themselves, they need to be able to protect themselves from liability. And one protection they must have is to know what they have in their custody. So, for example, let's say they come in to have custody, lawful custody, of something that's a container, but they don't know what's in the container. They just know that they have custody, temporary custody of this container. They're not saying it's evidence. They're just saying they have this custody of this container because it was where a crime happened. And that falls within their custody at that time. So the inventory search exception to the warrant requirement would mean it's an administrative law that allows the government to protect itself against liability. It also allows the government to protect itself against damage to itself from a physical threat perspective in case there's a bomb or explosives or some kind of harmful material in there, flammable material. Perhaps, don't want to say it, but other threats as well from a biological perspective or chemical perspective. And so you have this warrant exception to the warrant requirement called an inventory search that is deemed reasonable. Remember, that's the word in the Constitution. Are you following this? Without a warrant. So in other words, they have a box and they take themselves to be able to get into the box to find out what it is, maybe who owns it. And that's an administrative thing, not a criminal search. All right. I know that's a mouthful. Now recall, they've taken possession of over 700 safety deposit boxes at this business and all of the premises, everything on the premises. Each box could possibly be rented by a different individual, and there are individuals that are not guilty of a crime and they don't have a warrant specifically for each individual who owns a box. Those individuals that have boxes there presumably want a high degree of privacy and expect it. The boxes are closed and locked. So they're in this inventory search. Does it cross over into becoming a criminal search? Because, and that's really the issue here. In other words, is this inventory search that's under administrative law, not criminal law, is that really a pretextual end run around the Constitution to get a criminal search to find evidence for someone they don't have a warrant for yet? They don't have probable cause yet. They want to get the probable cause from the search. Is that putting the cart before the horse, though, in terms of the Constitution? Is ordinarily you need probable cause first before getting the warrant by oath or affirmation. You can't just get a warrant with no probable cause because that would put the cart before the horse. That would mean that anytime the government may merely even doesn't like you, or just see something that you have that they want. Well, then, if there's no probable cause required, shoot, they could just grab the warrant would issue whether or not someone staked their reputation on it or not by oath or affirmation. It would be a matter of pure convenience. Well, the framers of our Constitution didn't want the right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures to hinge on the mere discretion and convenience and whim of government officials. What could possibly go wrong? And by the way, what would even make it a right against search and seizure, unreasonable search and seizure, if it just did hang on the whim or to pure discretion without probable cause? If it didn't have to be reasonable. That's what this case is about. And remember, it's Republicans fixing a Republican mistake. Go back over and check that out in the early episode.
You're not making this entertaining enough. I need to be entertained.
One of the most important features of the doctrine is the existence of standardized instructions. Standardized need not mean written. Rather, our case law indicates that standardized instructions limit the discretion of officers. Ooh, I like the sound of that. And apply consistently across cases. Merriam-Webster Dictionary, says standardized means brought into conformity with a standard done or produced in a standard consistent way. For example, in U.S. versus Mancera Londoño. That's a Ninth Circuit, 1990. Defendants sought to suppress the fruits of an inventory search. They asserted followed policies which were not sufficiently standardized because they were unwritten. The panel rejected that argument. Remember, these Ninth Circuit reviews of district court are initially three-judge panels, usually. The panel rejected that argument, noting that regardless of the policy's form, the oral policy was identical to those found in the DEA's manual for forfeiture, which required return of all rental cars to the rental agency and an inventory of the same prior to the return. The need for standardized policy is necessarily a feature of the inventory search doctrine, because if an inventory is conducted pursuant to a standardized policy, a court knows that such a search would have been conducted regardless of the degree of suspicion an officer has of a person or an automobile's criminality. In other words, a court can be assured, reassured, that regardless of motive, an inventory will reveal what it will reveal, as it requires an officer to do the same thing every time. That presumably is a reason why, at least in this circuit, dual motives are permissible in the inventory search context. Dual motives are permissible. How do I parse this out to you? They have in their possession stuff. They don't know what's in there. They don't know what's in the automobile. They don't know what's in the cargo hold. They don't know what's in the locked box. They don't know what's in the backpack or the bag or the suitcase. Whatever it is, the shoebox, whatever it is, they have in their possession something that contains something else. They have written policies or unwritten. They're standardized policies that protect the government agency from liability that allows them to see what they are in custody of. It's not supposed to be a criminal search, it's merely an administrative search. Sometimes it's called an inventory search doctrine. Okay, so it is a search, but it's for purposes of inventory. Now, he said dual motives are permissible. What that means is, as long as you have the motive of complying with the standardized policy for inventory, it doesn't matter what other motive you have, it doesn't matter. What it's saying is, if you have the motive, the government search agent has the motive to comply with standardized policy of inventory, what you have in your custody, that is a sufficient condition for constitutionality. It doesn't matter that he personally thinks you're guilty as hell and cannot wait to get in that box and find evidence that you're guilty of hell and say, I knew it, and guess what? We're using this to take you down. It doesn't matter. From a constitutional perspective, all that matters is you had that one good motive, no matter what other motives you also had. That is, in the case of inventory searches, The mere presence of a criminal investigatory motive or dual motive, a valid one and one impermissible, does not render an inventory search invalid. Now, for some of you, maybe you're hearing this and you're like, I never knew that. Well, yeah. I'm glad. I'm glad you got something out of this. Well, then go over to Venmo, type in at the Republican Professor, dig deep in your money, send it over. That keeps us going. And by the way, drop me a comment. Let me know this helped. Share it with a friend. Share it with an enemy. Share it with a family member. If an officer follows a truly standardized policy, it is inevitable that he or she would find evidence of a crime, regardless of whether he or she intends it. However, if an agency is given the discretion to create customized inventory policies based on the features of each car it impounds and each person it detains, the ensuing search stops looking like an inventory meant to simply protect property. Well, and also protect the government from liability. It looks more like a criminal investigation of that particular car or person. Unlike inventory policies followed in the leading inventory search cases, which were all standardized to the extent they pre-existed the search of the car or the arrestee and applied consistently across subjects or of inventories, the supplemental instructions in this case were designed specifically for USPV this raid, these plaintiffs. In other words, they were discretionary. They were not standardized. They were customized. They were not standardized. I'm on page 1262, US v. Snitko, Ninth Circuit, 2024. Now, why would the judge say that? You can see where this is going. The judge is now holding the fabric of the defense, that would be the FBI, and taking a Zippo lighter and going like that and burning a hole right through their defense. That's very interesting and it's very encouraging. Unlike the inventory policies followed in the leading inventory search cases, which were all standardized, they didn't do that here. That is apparent from the title of the instructions. The testimony of their author and the introduction, which prefaces the instructions by explaining the agents were to be authorized to seize the facilities of the target business and conduct an inventory of the contents therein. The district court, which recognized a difference between the supplemental instructions and the FBI's standardized ones, seemed to believe that the inventory search doctrine was nonetheless applicable, because the agents merely followed the supplemental instructions in addition to the FBI standardized ones. But once the government begins adding a set of customized instructions to a standardized inventory policy, particularly the type of custom instructions presented in this case, the entire search stops being conducted pursuant to a standardized policy, regardless of whether the customized instructions conflict with the standardized ones. Here, the fact that the supplemental instructions were created specifically for USPV search takes this ca case out of the realm of standardized inventory procedure. We note that it is particularly troubling that the government has failed to provide a limiting principle to how far a hypothetical inventory search conducted pursuant to standardized instructions can go. At oral argument, for example, the government failed to explain why applying the inventory exception to this case would not open the door to the kinds of writs of assistance the British authorities used prior to the founding to conduct limitless searches of an individual's personal belongings. It was those very abuses of power, after all, that led to the adoption of the Fourth Amendment in the first place. Wow, what a powerful thing to say. We need a limiting principle. The limiting principle can't be that the government can just do what it wants and make up whatever custom discretionary things for each individual search if it's going to be without a warrant, which this search was without a warrant. The warrant said you can't look in every single box to do a criminal search. There's got to be probable cause of each individual block's owner to do a criminal search. Otherwise, it's unreasonable. You can do an inventory search. I know this sounds like you're talking out of both sides of your head, but you know. So I'm really encouraged by this. I don't know about you, but I am. I'm really encouraged by this. And we got a little bit more to go. But I want you to know that where this is headed, they're going to drive a Mack truck through this. The next section is the district court abused its discretion in holding the government did not exceed the scope of the warrant. And we're going to get to that next time. It's Friday, 17 January 2025. It's never been more important to support the work of the Republican Professor. You can hit us up on Venmo at the Republican Professor. Every penny counts. It keeps us going. It really does. It thank you so much for your help. One of the things that supporters did with their donations last year was help get me to Colorado to go to a funeral for the late Master Sergeant retired John Boswell, First Special Forces Operational Detachment Delta, retiree, Silver Star awardee, Purple Heart. And that was something I really needed to do. He was an inspiration to this project. It was one of my, he was my best friend in graduate school. The last several years I was working on a PhD, we finished at the same time. Him and I had the same dissertation chair, and some committee members overlapped with same professors, some courses we had. John Boswell was someone I needed to say goodbye to in that circumstance. There were other people, you know, famous people from Black Hawk Down, where he fought. That's where he was awarded the Silver Star. Like that guy Hoot, I met him in the kitchen of his, guess it was his sister, afterwards. I didn't even know who he was because he's so short. I didn't. Eric Bana played him in the movie. I didn't even know who he was till later. Hoot said to me that Norm Hooton, that John had mentioned the work that I did, and he said some very complimentary things. He said about not specifically the Republican Professor project, but just the work I did in the classroom. And he thanked me for my service and in the classroom, and said that it was something to be quite proud of, coming from him. That meant a lot. I didn't even know who I was talking to at the time. John was very impressed with the work I did in the classroom, the stories I used to tell him, and I tried to get him to go into the classroom too, and I tried to I tried to enlist him in this battle, in a new battle. And last year was marked by his absence in a very significant way. I only want to honor him. That's what I told Norm Hooten and the other guys there. There were several other guys from the Delta, and who were in that battle, Black Hawk Down. And some of them followed up with me about some of the material that we had on the podcast last year, featuring the writings of John Boswell. You can check those out in Apple Podcasts and also on YouTube. YouTube was so nice to leave that stuff up. We're so grateful for YouTube for not censoring us unreasonably and ridiculously like they did in 2022. Thank you so much, YouTube. It's helpful that we have somebody that's not totally crazy that now owns what used to be Twitter. I don't know where we'd be without that. So thank you, Elon Musk. And we're looking forward to moving on in 2025, hopefully making the world a better place. But we got a lot of work to do, and but we've come so far. So that's the kind of thing that your donations help me. It, I penny pinch. I really do. I'm not getting ahead in life. Don't worry about me buying a house with your donation. I'm just trying to make it, man. You know what I mean? It's been really rough here in California with these fires. It's sad because these fires are in the places I used to teach. I've taught 12 colleges and universities. The fires have affected at least 7 of the 12 colleges and universities that I taught at. At least 7. And it has affected all the commutes that I've had that involve those 7 campuses. And let me tell you, the hollowed out, charred out remains from these fires was there already spiritually and educationally on these campuses. These campuses are a hollowed out, charred out, decaying remnants of a former civilization in the hearts and minds of the students and faculty. And the grief I've seen there, just on the campuses, in terms of spiritually, morally, and intellectually, is analogous to the kind of desolation you're seeing in the wake of these fires. On a more cheerful note, the voters of Los Angeles and California are slightly closer to doing what Republicans do as a matter of course, expecting competence from the people they voted into office. But as I'm fond of saying, you cannot expect competence from elected officials if the voters themselves are not competent in expecting excellence. And I'm not talking about DEI and all that crap. That stuff is the opposite of excellence. It's ditching excellence for optics and feel-good performances. This podcast is about educating voters, citizens, to take charge of their own intellectual and moral development. If you want to be in charge of America, who is running the United States. Who's running your state, your county, your city, your local school board? Well, then you got to level up. And I know it's hard. I know there's a lot of work. And I know you're very busy. And I know you got a lot of stresses. But you can make some progress. And so that's what we're doing here on the Republican Professor. Thanks again. We'll see you next time.